Thanks, Holly, and thanks for PPMD for inviting me to present at this conference. I don't have a plane to catch, so I will be around to answer questions, whether as part of the panel or afterwards. I'm going to give an update on what's happening at Sarepta. And I'm excited that there's a couple more forward-looking statements that have been shared today. Two companies in the last couple weeks who were focused on DMD went public. And this is a good thing. You might just see it as, okay, that's how investors invest in stocks. But this means that people are paying attention. There's a lot of interest in investing in DMD. And so I'm very excited about that, to see my colleagues across the industry with the ability to go public. So I will be making some forward-looking statements today. This is my third PPMD Connect conference. And last year I was here, and we were in a very different place as a company. We were struggling, frankly. We did not have much cash. People were wondering if we were going to survive. We had less than $30 million on the balance sheet, and we were burning more than that in a given year. And so we had some very interesting data in that four patients out of 12 who had received our drug eteplirsen for 24 weeks showed dystrophin. But it wasn't translating at that point to a clinical benefit that was clear. And so I remember attending this conference in June of last year and wondering what was going to be the fate of this program. I'll also say I met a woman, Jen McNary, for the first time, who had a son in our study and another son who was non-ambulant who wasn't getting access to the drug. And she was very impassioned, as you saw she is today as well. And it really made me realize that she believed this drug was working before we even knew it was working. And that was something that was giving me hope at the time. And it was about a month after this meeting last year that we had the first real signal of clinical benefit. And it's been a big year for the company. And I'd say it's representative of how transformational the year has been for DMD in general. I attended a meeting this morning with industry representatives for all types of DMD drugs. And I remember last year that meeting took place, and it was the longest table of people all involved in DMD, drug companies and research. And this year it was even longer. And there were probably about 40 people around the table. And so I think there's so many signs around us saying it's a great time to be involved in DMD, where there's really hope that it looks tangible and looks more near-term than at any point in history. And the media has paid attention as well. We've seen a lot of press coverage across all of the companies in DMD, and we've gotten our fair share of that media attention as well. and some of these, again, Jen McNary took her story about the promise of eteplirsen to many media outlets. But it really helped raise awareness, not only of our program, but of DMD in general. And we hope that we sit here today that people outside of this room know more about DMD. And people who hadn't heard of Duchenne now have heard about it. So, again, we're really excited. We think it's been a transformational year in the past year. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our clinical data set. But I'm also really interested in telling you what we're planning to do with our eteplirsen data set and how that can lead to the promise of other exon-skipping drugs and making drugs available for boys who aren't amenable to an exon 51 skipping drug. We already have three additional exon-skipping targets in preclinical development, targeting exon 53, exon 45, and exon 50. And we think that developing these additional exon-skipping drugs could pave the way toward having another additional 20 exon-skipping drugs approved for DMD for the rarest mutations. And I'll talk a little bit later in the presentation about how we intend to do that. But first, we needed to show the proof of concept that we can restore dystrophin into the muscle. And as you all know, that this disease is caused by a lack of dystrophin and an inability of the patient to produce dystrophin because of genetic mutations that are out of frame in the dystrophin gene. So this was our real initial proof of concept. Can we show that with systemic-based delivery, inject the drug, and can we take a biopsy from a large extremity muscle and show dystrophin in robust levels consistently? So this is what we've aimed to do, and we did that through exon skipping, and many have talked at this meeting and previously about exon skipping. I won't go through the technology, but it's very elegant in that we know exactly what exon the bad actor is to fix the mutation and make it in frame. And we can do this regardless of your genotype, okay, if it's out of frame and we want to convert it to in frame, regardless of how rare. And we do this, we've done this initially with our lead drug, eteplirsen. And what you see on the right-hand side is the chemical structure of eteplirsen. And we think this is very differentiating, that it allows us to dose to much higher levels without seeing any toxicities to date, right, that we would call dose limiting. And it's important to understand that these little bases that you see on this chemical structure, those are the building blocks of DNA, RNA. This is the ACT and Gs. And the only difference between eteplirsen and what drug your boy might need, okay, if he needs a different exon-skipping target than 51, is the order and length of the sequence that we assemble with the same chemistry. And so we believe essentially the drug-like properties are the same. We believe that you can have a similar dose. It would be manufactured the same way. And the only difference is the order and assembly of those subunits, we call them. And that's important when we talk about getting the other exon-skipping drugs approved as rapidly as possible and eventually what we would describe as a class approval. But first, let me describe some of our data that generated a lot of attention this past year. And this is still ongoing. All the boys in our study, there are 12 patients, continue to receive the drug and continue to be followed for safety and clinical outcome measures. There was a placebo phase where we really wanted to understand the role of dystrophin, the impact of dose and duration of our drug on the production of dystrophin. And what we learned in this is that with our drug, at the doses we've tested, you need to dose for at least 12 weeks to 24 weeks before you can see dystrophin materialize in the muscle tissue. And so what that means is that there may be a slightly delayed effect of the treatment. And so in the first 12 weeks, you're not going to see it. But by week 24, you should have enough dystrophin where you should start to see a clinical benefit conferred right beyond that initial 12 weeks of treatment. And we learned this in the first stage of the study, and then in the follow-up, we really started to see the clinical evidence of this. These are the baseline characteristics. I just want to highlight that these boys, upon enrollment, were on average over 9 years of age. And now that we followed them out beyond a year and a half, this is important, where their average age is now 11 years for those who received eteplirsen in the treatment arm, almost 11 for the placebo patients. And I'll highlight also the six-minute walk baseline test in what you're going to see today with six-minute walk was around 380 to 388 here in terms of a mean value of a six-minute walk. So first, a little bit on our dystrophin. We were surprised on how consistent and robust the dystrophin levels were as we defined the primary endpoint as dystrophin-positive fibers. So what we did is we took a muscle biopsy from the biceps, and we took that muscle tissue and we looked at 24 different sections of that muscle biopsy. We stained them independently, quantified them independently. These were blinded reviews. And then we averaged those scores. And on top of that, we subtracted any noise or any values that we got at baseline to make the most conservative estimate of dystrophin-positive fibers. And with that, after 48 weeks of treatment, essentially, half of the fibers that were counted across all of these muscle biopsies at 48 weeks were positive for dystrophin, 47%, a little bit higher with 30 milligrams per kilogram, but comparable to the 50 milligram per kilogram. And placebo patients who had 24 weeks of treatment had more than a third of dystrophin-positive fibers after 24 weeks of treatment. And this was pretty consistent across the individual patients. You can see the bars represent the first two cohorts were 48 weeks of treatment, the highest bars, and then the placebo crossovers on the far right with 24 weeks of treatment. And what we did is we had immunofluorescent staining, and so you can actually look at what an example of those muscle tissues look like. And you can see pretreatment, it's essentially black. You don't see any discernible dystrophin in the muscle tissue. After 24 weeks, you start to see it materialize, so this is very encouraging. And then at 48 weeks, you see even more evidence of dystrophin, and this is what's reflected in the numbers that I shared with you. And this is just an example of the evolution of the dystrophin production. And on the far left, you have what a Duchenne boy typically looks like in their muscle tissue. And on the far right is a normal. This is a healthy control, not a Becker, but what our muscle tissue would look like with dystrophin. And you can see if, I like to say, if you were to ask anybody what that 48 weeks of treatment with eteplirsen, what does that look more like? Does it look more like the one on the far left or the one on the far right? I think it suggests we're getting closer to healthy muscle tissue. We're not where Becker typically is, but I think we're getting close. And I think it's very encouraging and supports the clinical benefit, we believe, that we're seeing in the six-minute walk, which I'll describe in a minute. We also have done other measures of the dystrophin via Western blot there on the left and RT-PCR to show that the length of the protein we're producing is akin to the Becker internally truncated dystrophin that we're producing. And furthermore, we get the question, well, how do you know it's a functional dystrophin? Well, one of the pieces of evidence we like to see is that we're restoring the dystroglycan complex, and we can stain for other glycoproteins, such as beta-dystroglycan, alpha-sarcoglycan, NNOS, neuronal nitric oxide synthase. And we've done this in a published article from our first Study 33 IM study. And we showed evidence of this restoration of the dystroglycan complex. And then at Jerry Mendell's site, we did some other glycoproteins that they had the assays for, beta-sarcoglycan, gamma-sarcoglycan. And on the far right, it's hard to see NNOS again, where we showed evidence of restoration of NNOS. So now I'll share with you the six-minute walk data that we've been sharing. And we just recently presented, about a week or so ago, 84-week data in our study. This is our primary endpoint. We, at baseline and at the measures where we took biopsies, we took two measures of six-minute walk. And our primary endpoint, we predefined that we're going to take the best score, regardless of placebo or treatment, but the best score at baseline and whenever we took two scores. So this is our primary endpoint where we take the maximum score. And you can see after over a year and a half, the eteplirsen-treated group on the top lost only 21 meters, where, again, they started maximum scores at baseline close to 400, okay? So essentially, less than 5%, okay, loss from baseline. In the placebo group, we started treating at week 24, but remember I said that we learned that the dystrophin doesn't materialize until week 24 from our previous data. So for the first 12 weeks, we would not expect to see a clinical benefit conferred. And sure enough, those placebo patients continued to decline until we were able to prove that we had dystrophin. We proved that at week 48. So from the last time point we had before dystrophin was confirmed in every one of these patients, that would be week 36, we have stabilized. Actually, numerically, they're doing a little better for now 48 weeks. These placebo patients, after they started to decline pretty precipitously, they started to stabilize. And when you look at the mean score, which is probably a more appropriate measure to understand where these boys are in their ambulation status, you see again less than a 2% decline from baseline in the treated group, and again you see the placebo group stabilized. So regardless of how we looked at it, we looked at minimum score as well. And when you look at minimum score, they haven't lost anything from the baseline. This delta that we see is described as clinically significant. Craig McDonald, who I think is going to speak here later today, has often said 10% difference is a real clinical outcome that you can believe is clinically relevant and meaningful. And so, again, we're very excited by these data and the stabilization that we continue to see, and we'll continue to follow these patients. But we really need to understand the context of the data that I'm sharing, and how does this stack up to what we know about natural history? And this is where the field, again, has been maturing and has been sharing more and more natural history. And I'm sure we'll see further updates from people like Eugenio Mercuri and Craig McDonald and others who continue to follow patients. But this was a slide that Giles presented earlier, showing what we know about when we take boys who are over 7 years of age versus those under 7 years, where they're still growing, their muscle masses are still increasing, and they're still improving on ambulation. And so here, the most data from a longitudinal study over 2 years, and he also looked on the left, the predictors of loss of ambulation based on their six-minute walk baseline status in terms of meters walked. And so I just highlight this because this is consistent with what happened to our placebo boys, okay, who were above age seven. I have to say, in looking at the GSK data that was just presented, it was interesting that the placebo group in that study lost 25 meters, and that was despite 40% or more of the patients being below 7 years of age. So you have to assume many of those under 7 years were growing. So if they lost 25 meters in the placebo group, then again, it's consistent to say even a younger population, greater than 7 years of age, is losing ambulation, that this is a progressive disease. We can't forget that. The idea that you might get lucky and enroll a few boys who are going to be stable and not lose any ambulation for a couple years, I think the field understands that's not what the data suggests. So what we've done is we've tried to summarize these natural history studies, and I look forward to GSK, I'm sure they'll share it at some point, is cutting their data by greater than 7 years of age to see how it stacks up to PTC study, where they shared greater than 7 years of age, our placebo arm, which is greater than 7 years of age, because that's a great data set to be able to guide the DMD community. But here we shared in the box the greater than 7 year decline that we would expect to see based on all of the studies that were done at a Lawrence placebo arm, the most recently reported McDonald publication. I know he has more data that he may be collecting and sharing. And then the Mazzone paper that I just described to you. And again, you see varying degrees of decline, but all of them are showing decline. And the Mazzone over 2 years, which were almost out 2 years, declined by a third. Okay, over 122 meters, where they started at a baseline of about 365, not much different than the 380 that I showed you in our placebo group. And then you see how the eteplirsen and the eteplirsen crossover have done. And this is what gives us confidence that this is a real treatment effect and that it's being caused or a result of the dystrophin that we're producing that I showed you earlier. And what happens is when you have data that looks too good to be true, you get a lot of critics to say, well, is that because one or two patients are doing so well, and is that what's driving the mean and the averages that you're sharing? So in the last few months, we started sharing the individual decline, and this is where it does hold up, patient by patient by patient. Every one of these boys, since they've produced dystrophin, has stabilized on their six-minute walk. And this is very encouraging, especially in light of Dr. Temple's presentation yesterday, where he said this is not about the size of your clinical trials. It's about your treatment effect. And that small trials with a treatment effect can be considered by the FDA. And many of you know we are in discussions with the FDA about how can we get this drug to the boys who need it as soon as possible. Can you use your mechanism that you have the authority to do under accelerated approval to allow us to submit an application that you would accept for filing under accelerated approval. So again, we're very encouraged by this. The placebo you see started to decline. All of them declined by more than 15% in that 36-week time frame. But since that time frame, they've all stabilized and have lost less than 5% or increased. Okay. And again, these are not young ambulatory boys. Okay. These are ambulatory boys that are 11 years of age on average in the eteplirsen arm, 10.4 years on the placebo. And Stan Nelson showed a really nice slide talking about the average age in which a wheelchair is initially needed, and it was between 9 and 13 years of age for the majority of that. So I think, again, there may be suggestions that some boys might be ambulant until they're 15 or 16. But we have 12 boys here who we've stabilized. And not only that, when you look at the placebo arm, at week 36, they were below 330 meters. This is not 350 meters and above. This is below 330, which the Mazzone paper said you shouldn't even enroll them in clinical trials because the risk of the loss of ambulation is so great in a 1 to 2 year time frame that you're going to be able to, you're going to confound your study and not see an effect. And we are showing an effect. So we're very excited about this data set. Safety. We now have over a year and a half of safety. And we've seen no treatment-related serious adverse events. We saw a couple transient proteinuria cases that resolved on a, this is a dipstick, a nonspecific proteinuria. None of those patients had elevated kidney marker elevation. So we are very encouraged by the safety and side effect profile to date. And many times we want to understand the treatment-related AEs and the serious adverse events or any adverse events that would lead to treatment interruption or discontinuation. And, you know, we're asked even by the FDA to look at special AEs like kidney toxicity. They're very concerned about renal toxicity, so they've asked us to look even more closely at renal toxicity. And again, we're, except for those transient cases I described, we're not seeing that. We're not seeing, injection site reactions, or was one incidence of pain. We're not seeing the inflammation. And we're very encouraged, especially when we have to think about that we're going to be trying to get this drug approved to be dosed in young boys for life, potentially. And so you really want to make sure that what you're infusing in these boys has some evidence that you can dose for the long term and no signals of safety concern. There has been a lot of interest and effort on Capitol Hill, and this was witnessed by the FIDASIA legislation that has been talked about a lot at this conference and elsewhere. And again, we think this has encouraged the FDA to look at diseases like Duchenne and support them with these accelerated approval guidelines that they have. And again, kudos to PPMD and Pat Furlong for putting a paper out basically highlighting that Duchenne absolutely qualifies for this FIDASIA legislation and the categorization of a rare disease that, that should meet the specifications. And again, we're it's been talked about there's no validated endpoints. 6-minute walk is the best we have. What we're trying to do at Sarepta is convince the FDA that dystrophin should be a validated surrogate marker. And we think this is critically important when we think about getting the other exon-skipping drugs approved as rapidly as possible. If they say yes, dystrophin is a surrogate for eteplirsen approval, that means we can look at dystrophin for exon 53 and exon 45 and exon 50 and exon 44 and all the exons that come after that and get those approved more rapidly. And so many of you might be thinking, well, eteplirsen's not going to help my boy, but eteplirsen's success may very well help your boy. And so, you know, all of you should understand the importance of our mission to get dystrophin accepted as a surrogate marker so that we can get all of the other exon-skipping drugs as rapidly approved as possible. And we think this is the perfect disease to apply this because the risk-benefit is so clear, especially if we have a safe drug that we are infusing, right, and we know the devastating progression of the disease and how irreversible it is. So, again, we appreciate all of you in this room who've supported this cause and this mission that we've been trying to achieve. We do have a confirmatory study that we're planning for eteplirsen. We are in discussions with the FDA of the specific design of that study. We are already identifying clinical sites, and we expect at the least sites in the U.S. and Canada. We expect to dose the first patient in the first quarter of 2014. And we are always engaging with the DMD community, and we're looking at maybe solutions to make it easier for you to engage with the company. But basically, here's an email, dmdinfo@sarepta.com, where we can you can reach out to us and ask us about clinical trials, tell us if you want your boy in a study, if you're a clinician and want to participate. So real briefly, I just want to highlight what we're trying to do to get the other exons approved. If I can just take another minute, Holly. So what I described about dystrophin as a surrogate is it's infeasible to think we can do clinical trials. I argue it's hard to do after eteplirsen, exon 51, because the competition for patients and competition for investigational agents. We're going to try to do a study cobbling together the next, you know, two or three exons. But after that, it becomes really impractical to expect to, you know, do a clinical trial to gain approval. And this is where we think we have a pathway where we can show dystrophin as a surrogate, prove that on three or four exon-skipping drugs, and then eventually have a full data set that's based on the in vitro exon-skipping, of which we're collaborating with Steve Wilton on, who has been a longtime collaborator with us. And if we can do that, that, we believe, is the fastest way that we can get the 25 drugs that are needed or so to treat every boy who could benefit in the Duchenne community from an exon-skipping drug. And we've expanded our collaboration with Steve to strengthen the sequences that we can actually apply with this technology. And again, Steve and many others who've helped us along the way, Francesco Montoni, Eric Hoffman, Jerry Mandel, we have people who've worked for the company like Pat Iverson and Richard Cole. And so we're very grateful and thankful for all of those who paved the way for this success of this program. And with that, again, this is a very important meeting. I don't think you see the kind of mixed audience that you see at the PPMD conference when you go to other disease and medical conferences or advocacy conferences. And this is a really beautiful thing about this community, is that we can all sit and have a dialogue and exchange, whether you're advocacy, whether you're a researcher, whether you're from industry. And so we're very excited to be part of this community. And we thank you for your support as we try to achieve our objectives, because, you know, our mission, and this is true with whether it's GSK or Percents or PTC, we all want to see our drugs make it to the patients as quickly as possible. We're all really motivated by that, and a lot of things can get in the way sometimes, but I think we all have our interests aligned, and we appreciate your support in helping us achieve our objectives. Thank you.